After WT dropped its claim, Fury fell even farther off the public radar. The lease expired. No one gave a boiled shit about it. Until an escape pod crashed there 10 years ago. That never made the news feeds. No, sir. That was need to know, and most people didn't need to know. The company did, of course, but only select groups within it. I never heard of it before last Tuesday. Not a word, not a peep. Until I needed to know. I just brought my team in from a dirty little job in a dirty little floating lab, orbiting a planet where the neo-Norse religious fruitcakes were building a new kind of hyperspeed torpedo for use against mercantile transports. Why they thought Odin would care about interstellar trade is beyond me. I was told to shut them down, and we shut them all the way down. Didn't lose a man, or woman for that matter, but we rained down hell on them. Good practice for some of my greener shooters, because the Neo-Norse were pretty tough. Not tough enough. We got to the way station, expecting a 3-day pass and a serious assault on the alcohol stores. But they were waiting for us with orders. Go to Fury 161 and find out who had landed at the old mine and turned on the lights. No one knew who was there. All we knew is that it wasn't us. So fuck it. We shipped out on a Starslip F-430. Yeah, one of the new ones. Looks exactly like a bullet. Big, blunt, ugly, fast. They loaded us into a launch platform and pulled the trigger. When we woke up, we were in orbit over the target. 4 people on the ship. 3 of us and a pilot. Pilot was a synthetic named Sid, who looked like my mother in guy's clothing. Not intended, just happened that way. Sid wasn't one of the chatty kind. He drove the boat, handled the wake-up call from hypersleep, and handled the post-transit briefing. I was first on deck, and had to answer the usual questions after waking up, just to make sure my brain hadn't turned to ice decaf. Name? Asked Sid. Ellen Harper. Rank? Master Sergeant, United States Colonial Marine Corps Force Recon. Went through the rest. Serial numbers, mother's maiden name, first pet. Lulu Hoops and Bax Patel came out next. Both E-5 sergeants, both old friends. We'd all walked through the Valley of the Shadow more times than I could count. Reliable, steady, lethal as fuck. Bax was the nice one, as far as that goes. Lulu was nasty as shit. They were our version of good cop, bad cop, but when it got real, they were both Marines, which meant they took zero shit from anyone on the wrong side of the line. I'd picked them because we'd worked 3-man gigs enough times to be halfway psychic with one another. Not really, but the way soldiers are. There's a thing that happens when people with the right training and enough practical experience can read each other with perfect clarity. A glance is a whole conversation. You know them all the way down to the marrow, and you've been in so many dicey situations that you are 100% positive you can trust them. Gets to the point where even in a firefight, we're all so aware of each other that we're handing over a fresh magazine before the guy next to us fires his last round. Like that. Once we'd shaken off the effects of the 4-week in-flight sleep, we clustered around Sid and he briefed us on the latest intel. Our ship was in a wide and irregular orbit, making use of all the orbiting space junk left over from the mining days. The Starslip was the latest generation of stealth tactical craft, so unless someone knew how to look for us, all they'd see is more junk among the junk. Certain elements of the mission have been marked restricted until we established orbit, explained Sid. Here's what we know. And he told us the real backstory to the crashed escape pod. The story didn't start on Fury. It started long before I was born. It started with a mining ship called the Nostromo, and it involved a horror show alien species, a true xenomorph. Sid told us about the only survivor of that ship, a flight officer named Lieutenant Ellen Ripley, a nobody who managed somehow to survive an encounter with a uniquely aggressive species. That was how Sid described it, uniquely aggressive. I saw Lulu and Bax swap looks. We hadn't heard any of this shit. Sid told us about Ripley destroying her ship after all the crew had been killed and escaping in a life pod. He told us about Ripley being in hypersleep for 57 years, about her getting found by a deep salvage team, about her being kicked to the curb by the company because no one believed her insane story, especially after she blew up her ship, and then how the colony on Acheron LV-426 went dark, which is the exomoon of Kalpamos, where Ripley's team had first encountered the xenomorphs. Then Sid told us the part that made my balls want to climb up inside my chest cavity. A team of colonial marines had been sent by WT to Acheron to assess the situation. And let's face it, to obtain the xenomorphs. The bioweapons division guys must have been creaming their jeans at the thought of what they could do with one of those. But everything went to shit. By the time the expeditionary force got there, the colonists were dead and the monsters were off the chain. Everyone died except one marine, a corporal named Hicks, a little girl who was the last surviving colonist, and, no shit, Ellen Ripley. And she nuked the whole atmosphere processing plant and turned a good chunk of that planet into a glow-in-the-dark back porch of hell. "This Ripley bitch likes blowing shit up," observed Lulu. "Kinda dig her." Back shook his head. "Why do I have a feeling that from now on, every time you blow something up, you're going to be saying you're going full Ripley?" Lulu thought about it, shrugged, nodded. "Could happen." Sid ignored them and told us about how the xenomorph had somehow infected Ripley during hypersleep, and because these fuckers had molecular acid for blood, the smoke from burning plastic triggered fire alarms in the life pods. The tubes containing the three survivors were transferred to a life pod and dropped into the atmosphere of the closest non-vital planet. Guess where? Fury.
"Fuck me," said Lulu. "Is this a rescue mission for them?"
"After all these years?" asked Bax. "We're coming pretty late to the prom." "No," said Sid. "Hicks and the girl were reported KIA when the pod crashed. Ripley was rescued by the prisoner miners, but there was at least one xenomorph on the pod. It escaped and killed most of the prisoners and all of the staff."
"Fuck me," whispered Bax. "Just one?"
"Just one," said Sid. "What about Ripley?" I asked. "Dead too. A xenomorph impregnated her, and she committed suicide to prevent the birth of a queen of that species."
"Impregnated how, exactly?" asked Lulu. "She get tired of blowing them up and decide to do the nasty with one?"
"I don't need that image in my head, thanks," said Bax. Sid explained about the life process of the xenomorph.
"But fuck me blind and move the furniture,"
Bax muttered, and he looked a little green.
"Did Ripley blow up the mine, too?" asked Lulu.
"Not this time," said Sid, and he explained how she organized the prisoners to try and destroy the alien by entombing it in molten lead. It hadn't worked, but she killed it anyway. To prevent anyone from harvesting the queen inside her, Ripley had thrown herself into the lead. There was nothing of her left to harvest. There was one survivor from the prison, but he was a nobody, and he vanished off the official record. Weyland-Yutani sent three separate science teams to scour the area, but they came up dry each time. The file on Phi Arena 161 was closed and filed away as an expensive waste of time and opportunities.
"So who's down there?" asked Bax.
"Unknown," said Sid. "The company left some satellites in orbit, and they started ringing bells."
"Squatters?" asked Lulu.
"Unlikely."
"Even so," she said, "how's this our gig? We roll out to protect civilians and protect WT assets, but nobody who signs our paychecks owns a stake in Fury anymore. So why are we all the way the fuck out here?"
Sid said, "We're picking up heat signatures from the mine and from a large super light-speed craft. It has stealth sheathing that's almost good enough to hide it from our sweeps." I grinned.
"Almost is a fun word.
Stealth tech is rampant, and some of it's good enough so some of the rival planets and rival corporations can't find each other. We can find nearly everyone, and no one, no fucking buddy, can find our birds. WT developed it for the military, but they've been using it for their own private ops, too, like ours. The fact that someone is bankrolling an expensive operation means they found something important on Fury. If it's important, then it legally belongs to WT.
"Legally?" echoed Bax, one eyebrow raised.
"Ethically, then," conceded Sid. Then he seemed to consider the weight of that word, too. "The company never formally relinquished the planet, and have since paid retroactive taxes and fees to fully reinstate their claim."
They own it, I said. Whose ship are we talking about? It's anyone's guess as to which corporation put a ship down there, said Sid. Whoever it is has money, though. No group of squatters could buy a ship like that. If they can afford that tech, said Bax glumly, then they can afford shooters to protect it. Agreed, said Sid. Lulu gave him a killer smile, thin and hard and ice cold. Fuck 'em. Lulu drove the dropship. She always drives like she's running from a bank heist. Bax kept praying to Ganesha, and I kept rechecking my safety harness. Stupid, I know, because if we crashed at the speed she used, all I'd be is a well-secured corpse. There was an ice storm turning the region around the mine into a winter wonderland, 22 below, with winds that turned snow into a fusillade of ice crystals. Lulu was singing some old-ass song about weed, whites, and wine. She steered with the shifts of the wind, so that if anyone was looking, we'd fade into the background motion dynamics like a piece of blown debris, if we showed up at all. With storm winds, there was always a chance of a shield panel flying off.
Hold on to your sacks, boys, yelled Lulu, because this is going to be a bumpy landing.
She wasn't joking, or underestimating. We hit the ground hard enough to make the impact suppression system cry out in protest. Everything rattled, from the deck bolts to the fillings in my teeth. When we deployed onto the surface, I thought Bax was going to fall down and kiss the dirt. Lulu grinned as she strolled out after us. Pussies, she said.
Kiss my brown ass, said Bax, but his voice trembled so bad there was no emphasis.
Okay, I snapped. Cut the chatter. I pulled up an area map on the tactical computer strapped to my forearm. Lulu and Bax touched theirs to mine to establish a dedicated team Wi-Fi and sync up the telemetry. We couldn't risk using satellite uplinks because of the danger of detection. We had a good path to the mine, and by good, I mean it was a hard scrabble pain in the balls. The kind of path no one in their right mind would ever use, which made it a good choice for coming up on the blind side of whoever was here. It took us 5 hours to go 6 kilometers. Along the way, we encountered rocks, more rocks, ice, more rocks, snow, and more motherfucking rocks. Once Bax saw a creature darting through a drift, but when Lulu popped it with a single silenced round, it turned out to be some kind of long-haired, six-legged something that none of us had ever seen before. It wasn't a xenomorph, though, so we left it in a blood-stained patch of snow and moved on. The winds were at our backs, which was some mercy because they were so strong it would have doubled the march time to walk into them. As it was, they pushed us forward. When we were half a click out, we stopped for warm water from our flasks and a full protein and electrolyte bar. Lots of calories, all the right nutrients, but they tasted like ass. Greasy, gritty ass, too. Small wonder they never caught on in civilian markets. We could feel the recharge, though, and after a 15-minute rest, we were ready to rock and roll. We crept to the top of a ridge of stone that rose from the shoreline of a frigid ocean and studied the tableau below.
Yeah, said Bax. Definitely not squatters.
The mining building was vast, more like a medieval castle back on Earth. Huge towers of stone and iron that rose into the stormy sky. Ice seemed to reach up its sides like clutching fingers. There were snow-covered heaps of ancient trash and shapeless chunks of metal. Nearby, a ship squatted on 8 powerful legs. It was a design I'd read about but never encountered. A Bylong-class exploration cruiser. 900 feet, with a 200-foot forward beam that tapered back to a slender tail. It was painted to look like its name, a white dragon, teeth and all, massive fusion engines, and an impressive and intimidating collection of gun ports and rocket pods pointing in every useful direction. I didn't like it, but now I understood it. Or some of it, anyway. Outside the reach of planetary government or star system alliances, there was no real law. Everything beyond the core systems was run by whoever could afford to provide infrastructure and protection. The Weyland-Yutani Company owned big, gaudy chunks of that real estate, but space was, let's face it, really fucking big. There was plenty of room and plenty of resources out there to encourage competition and an entrepreneurial drive on an epic scale. After WT, there were some dozen next-tier corporations,
and on the tier below that, maybe 300 smaller ones. The only company that offered any real competition to WT was the Jingti Long Corporation, based on New China. They had 12 star systems, and business interests in everything from novelty genetically engineered pets to heavy metals mining to pharmaceuticals. Total number of employees was 16 million, give or take. So yeah, big. They call their special operators Wugong, which means centipedes. Comes from the type of combat rig they wear that has a lot of extra extendable arms capable of using autonomous fire weapons. I've gone toe-to-toe with some of their teams on disputed asteroids and planets. They buried some of my boys, and I buried a bunch of theirs. We failed to bond. Fuck me, murmured Bax, because he lost 10 inches of intestine 3 years ago after a dust-up with a Wugong kill team. Sweet, said Lulu, because she didn't like anyone and was always turned on by the prospect of a fight with someone worth fighting. I said nothing. This was a day on the job, and they don't pay me to have opinions. Beyond the ship was an area that had been cleared off by bulldozers, and in the center of it was the squat, ungainly, and clearly damaged hulk of a Type 337 EEV military lifeboat. It was one of those old-fashioned ones that didn't look like it was deigned to do anything but fall. Badly. Small portable field work shelters had been erected, and interior light made them glow. We saw no one moving. Maybe they're all inside to get out of the storm, suggested Bax. Lulu, I said, thermals. She flipped down her visor and tapped the temple controls to cycle from ordinary vision to thermal scan. Got 'em. How many and where? Nothing in the lifeboat, nothing in the work tents, but a shit ton in the ship. Give me a count. She chewed her lip. Can't lock down a hard number. Some in the forward part of the ship. Call it 18. But most of the signals are soft, like the cooling. Some trace signatures, too. Dozens of those, but I can't get an active read on them. Could be the shielding messing with the sensor, suggested Bax. Maybe, I said. What else? There's a cluster in the engine room, but that's even muddier. I think they're clustered around the reactor. Clustered? Looks like it. Jammed in so tight I can't count individual signatures. Best guess is 10. I squinted at the ship. That's a 70-man boat. Big damn ship to land, said Lulu. I'd love to see what they have under the hood. Where's the crew? Asked Bax. In the mine? Ventured Lulu, then shook her head. No. Even with interference from the structure, I'd get something, and it's stone cold dead in there. It was a bad choice of words, and she realized it as soon as she said it. What's the play, boss? She asked to cover her words. We didn't come out here to be bystanders, I said. We go down, scout the ground, and then see about getting onto that ship. Rules of engagement? Asked Bax. I nodded to the lifeboat. That came off a Marine Corps ship, which means it's our property. The mine and everything else belongs to the people we work for, which makes everyone on that ship looters. Personally, I do not play well with kids who try to steal my toys. Lulu and Bax smiled. They weren't nice smiles. I doubt mine was either. We came down quietly, making maximum use of cover, guns up and out, taking turn running point whenever we changed direction. We went to the Sulaco lifeboat first and peered inside. I expected it to be a charred mess, but I was wrong. We paused to stare at what had been done to it. It was a shell. Every piece of equipment, every control panel, every inch of wiring was gone. The Jingti Long science geeks had done the most thorough job of stripping a ship that I've ever seen. I don't get this, boss, said Bax very quietly. Why strip it out? The boat crashed, some of it burned. Nothing left inside was of any use even in a fire sale. Yeah, agreed Lulu. Long damn way to come to get used parts. Which means it's not why they came, I said. Ripley got implanted with the alien embryo aboard that boat. There had to be at least one of those facehugger sons of bitches on board. Sure, said Bax. But I thought WT science teams have been all over this stuff. Maybe they missed something, said Lulu with a shrug. Or maybe they have better ways of looking, I said.
You know how Jingti Lang operates. They always take a weird left-field approach to everything. They've jumped the line in tech development a lot of times, so maybe they figured out how to do what the WT Nerd Squad failed to do. It was true enough. Even though Weyland-Yutani was the big dog in the technologies market, there was a good reason why Jingti Lang was constantly nipping at their heels. From what I'd read, I figured it was an even split between really good R&D and really good corporate espionage. Bax and Lulu looked at the boat, then at the mine, and then at me.
"So what you're saying," Lulu began, "is that this whole thing is about these assholes trying to harvest aliens?"
"Xenomorphs," corrected Bax, but Lulu ignored him.
"Maybe," I said. "We don't know, but I think we'd better find out before they go and do something stupid."
As we moved off, I could feel ice form in the pit of my stomach. Sid had told us a lot about the xenomorphs, and they were some nasty-ass critters, hard as hell to kill, with that acid blood, some weird extendable mouth, strong and apparently vicious in the extreme. If all they'd ever done was kill a flight crew on a cargo ship or the unarmed prisoners in a mine, I wouldn't be too worried. But they'd slaughtered an entire platoon of Marines on Acheron. Our mission parameters included securing any specimens, in whole or part, for return to the WT labs. But what trumped that was to make sure no one else walked off with so much as a fingernail from the creatures. That would give the competition something our team hadn't yet managed to acquire, which would result in something a lot worse than stock drops when Jingti Lang developed it into a bioweapon. That could shift more than the economic balance of power. With xenomorphs on the leash, Jingti Lang could start, and likely win, a war. We used the heaps of debris to hide our approach, but then Bax tapped my arm and nodded to the security cameras mounted along the sides of the Jingti Lang ship. The small sensor lights were all dark. I looked around. All the work lights in the camp were still on, but there wasn't anything showing in the ship's few portholes.
"Is that good or bad?" asked Bax.
"Nothing's good on this rock," I said.
We did a complete circuit of the ship and found no trace of activity. The engine housing was still warm, but that would be on its own system because it takes too long to restart those babies and is easier and cheaper to leave them in idle. We ended our recon at the rear hatch, and that's where we found the blood. There was a lot of it. Too much of it. We stopped and stood at the edge of a wide puddle that could not have been made from what was in the veins of a single man. 6-7, maybe. Lulu knelt and waved her hand to indicate hundreds of tiny islands in that lake of red. Shell casings. There are lumps of meat, too. I heard Bax mumbling a prayer.
Om Gum Ganapati Nama.
It was a prayer of protection to Ganesh, the Hindu god who removes obstacles and offers protection. Lulu said nothing. She generally didn't believe in anything. But she knew this wasn't the moment to mock someone who was calling for support. No atheists in foxholes, especially on planets this far from home. We looked at the rear hatch. It stood ajar, and through the 5-inch gap, all we could see was a black nothing, except on the door frame, on which was a bloody handprint. It was not made by a human hand. We stood there, barrels pointed at the door, none of us speaking. I was scared, I admit it. We all were. The Chinese team had come here to find what the Weyland-Yutani guys had missed. An egg, maybe? A facehugger? Some DNA? Something. And they'd found it. Or it had found them. I tried to do the math in my head based on the mission intel. From the sketchy data collected so far, we knew the xenomorphs grew fast. Real fast. The one on the Nostromo went from egg to infant to full-sized killer in under a day. Scary thought. Very scary thought, considering that there were 70 or more people on the Jingti Lang ship. How'd they grow one, though? Did they find an egg hidden on the lifeboat? Unlikely. Our boys would have found something like that. Unless... When Ripley was rescued from the crashed boat, it was days before the killings in the mine began, and even longer before the first WT team arrived. We knew that one of the facehuggers must have gotten to Ripley because she was impregnated, or whatever we should call what happened to her. There had to be a second facehugger,
because a xenomorph began killing everyone in the mining facility. Had there been a third? Or fourth? How many had come down to Fury with Ripley, Hicks, and the girl? How many had survived the crash? How many had escaped into the frozen wasteland of this world? Was that what the Chinese worked out? Had they come here in the hopes of finding something that wasn't on board the lifeboat, but which had escaped from it? That handprint seemed to be a mocking, ironic statement. It told us that everyone involved in this op was stupid, suicidally stupid. Even knowing what we knew about these creatures, we had underestimated them, time and time again, on the Nostromo, on Acheron, on the Sulaco, on Fury 161. Mistakes every step of the way, because civilizations as technologically advanced as ours make those kinds of mistakes. What do they call it? Hubris? Something like that. Us thinking we're smarter than nature, and when has that ever been the case? We should have learned that lesson in the 21st century, when all those diseases they thought they'd beaten came back because people used antibiotics the wrong way. What was the death toll in the 2020s and 2030s? 65 million? Something like that. The same for the first Mars colonies, when they thought they'd be able to do workarounds to the problems of radiation and bacteria in the ice there. I visited the graveyard once. Out of the first 50 colonists they sent, 48 of them died of cancer or infections from unknown bacteria. We're fucking idiots, a lot of the time. "What's the call, boss?" asked Bax, but I didn't answer right away. Instead, I looked from that open door up to the clouds. Our mission was to secure the location, but to also secure any and all biological samples. "Of this?" "Jesus Christ," I said. And the others cut me sharp looks. I kept my gun pointing at the line of darkness between door and hatch. "I want you to listen to me," I said very softly. And I told them exactly what I'd been thinking. All of it. They stood their ground and listened. "We're not on the policy level, boss," said Bax. "I know. We're here to do a job," said Lulu. "I know." Deep inside the ship, we heard a sound, a single human scream, of pain, of use, and a terrible resignation, as if something was being done to body and soul that the mind could not escape but could not bear. Then the voice cried out something in Chinese that none of us could understand. Except that we did. Not the words, but the meaning. The intent. It was a prayer. Screamed out so loud it was hard to tell if the voice belonged to a man or a woman. A piercing shriek that was way past the point where it was begging for mercy. It was begging for release. The scream rose and rose, and then it disintegrated into wetness. And then silence. Absolute and awful. Bax licked his lips. "And that's what they want us to take back to Earth?" "Yeah," I said. "Good," he said. "Yeah." Bax held his gun firm, but he took a single step backward. Not a retreat, exactly. More like a statement. Lulu turned sharply toward him. "What are you doing?" she demanded. Bax didn't answer, but he took another step backward. "We have a job to do." "Yes, we do," I said. Now she turned to me, frowning because of something she heard in my voice. She started to say something, but there was a new sound from inside, a different kind of shriek, high, but not human. No, not human at all. We listened. It came again. And it was closer this time. "Boss?" asked Lulu, and now there was doubt in her voice. Another scream, and another. No, two of them overlapping, not one creature. We listened. We heard them. Them. The screams. And beneath that sound was a scraping, slithering, clicking jumble of noises, coming toward us from the deep black beyond that narrow opening. "They want us to bring this back to Earth." This time it was Lulu who spoke. Her voice was hushed. All of the bravado was gone. When I turned to look at her, I saw that she had backed up and stood beside Bax. Yeah, I said. No, she said. No, said Bax. I put the stock of my rifle against my shoulder. No, I said.
Distressed by James A. Moore. Perkins was looking right at Callahan when her head exploded inside the hard shelter of her environment helmet. Her eyes had an instant to bulge, and then there were bits of her skull slipping down the interior of the visor, along with the blood and gray matter.
Fuck me!
Foe let out his usual battle cry and cut loose on the metallic demon coming their way. The PAR-320 fired hot pulses of burning plasma all over the bloodied limb that was even now trying to rip Perkins from the armor. She was already dead, but Callahan couldn't stop hearing her screams. 3 hours ago they were en route to Litowel Habitat for R&R. 10 minutes later, they had the distress call from the Shiname Maru. Being Colonial Marines, they responded, even though most of them were due for a rotation out of the stink of their armor. The suit from Weyland-Yutani, the company that owned the supply ship in distress, promised a bonus if the work was handled quickly. Never let it be said that credits couldn't grease a few gears. From the outside, the ship looked just right, as long as you ignored the eye-aching lights coming off of whatever the hell had hit it. Not a ship of any known kind, but according to the captain, it was bigger than what they saw, and at least half of it was spilling out light in spectrums no human eye could see. Those same lights were causing the pain. They couldn't be seen, but they could burn out a retina in under 2 minutes without protection. The suit from Weyland-Yutani wanted samples of that, too. There would be bigger bonuses. Callahan loved incentives. All of which meant exactly shit when the thing from inside that vessel came for them. 10 minutes away, they got the skinny on the situation. Whatever had hit the ship had taken out command. Intentionally or not, no one could say. But the piloting crew was likely dead, the command center was ruined, and most of the surviving crew reported being locked in the back of the Shiname Maru, along with the supplies to start terraforming another planet. At least 15 dead were missing, and the ship was bleeding atmosphere everywhere that wasn't sealed away with the remaining crew. The Marines were going in hot, and they were going in sealed in their cans. They were also going in without much visual backup. The same lights that hurt their heads also fragged their helmet cams. Dumariste, the ops station runner, was doing what he could, but there wasn't much he could offer except what could be seen from outside the Shiname Maru. So far, that was enough to let them know that whatever was out there was bigger than it looked. 2 minutes inside, and all they saw was blood, broken bits of frozen corpse, shattered machinery, and debris moving around inside the main deck. The artificial gravity was shot, and everything that wasn't sealed in place was bouncing around at different speeds. It was like being inside a madman's snow globe. Mag boots kept them standing on the surfaces of their choice. Most took the floor just for familiarity's sake. 50% standard gravity, which didn't hurt when you were locked in environmental armor. Perkins had tapped her portable workstation into the ship and was trying to assess all of the details, when the metallic limb telescoped down the corridor leading to the breach and punched a hole through hardened armor and her head. Foe, one of the biggest men Callahan knew, had let out his fuck me and started shooting, and now seemed as good a time as any to join into the fray. Plasma strobed down the corridor and fried whatever it touched. The bursts were small, they had to be, in closed environments, but they did their work well enough. A stray shot melted Perkins's armor to her leg. She was too dead to complain, but whatever had hold of her didn't seem to care. The metallic limb kept pulling her down the length of the ship toward the breach. The Shiname Maru was nothing remarkable, typical industrial-grade freight hauler with preformed walls in the areas where the crew lived and worked. The rest of it was metal, and more metal, with just enough insulation to protect the pipes from clumsy human hands. The walls were white polymer shielding that flashed past as they ran after what was left of Perkins. Captain Ogambe yelled through the comlink, "Don't get yourselves killed in the hunt, assholes! A little caution!" Ogambe was a soldier, same as them. They tended to listen, but whatever was taking Perkins away had killed one of theirs, and that left a bad taste in Callahan's mouth. Foe had been on over 50 missions with Perkins. The sergeant referred to her as little sister, when he wasn't busy trying to get her naked. Foe was beyond pissed. He charged hard down the starboard corridor. The port side split from near the airlock and left a lot of room for sleeping quarters and mess hall. Starboard side was where the glowing thing had punched through the hull. Their magnetic boots clanked with each step, but the standard sound was missing. The mags didn't lock down with a full gravity, they did about a half. Running was easier than it should have been. Foe came from a colony where the gravity was almost 50% higher than Terra norm. It was a wonder he hadn't smashed his head into the ceiling above him. Behind him, the rest of the squad was heading along, and damn near every one of them was pissing and moaning into the comm about how badly they were going to fuck up the xenomorph that had killed Perkins. Callahan did his best to stay chilled. Angry made for sloppy. A little anger was okay, it helped keep you alert. But more than that made you focus on the wrong things. Poe caught a reminder of that when a second limb rolled out from the corridor ahead of them and tried to punch through him. He managed to slip to the side and got cut along his chest, but it was only a grazing wound. Still, the nanofibers in the armor started weaving the hole shut. Good thing, or he'd be dead in 2 minutes from exposure and lack of atmosphere. It sobered him up, though. Took the rage down to a better place.
"Fucking hell!"
Foe grumbled.
"Easy goes it."
Callahan slowed down, looked his companion over, and nodded. His armor was doing what it was supposed to do. Foe had painted several characters in Chinese on the armor. He'd be touching up a few of them. The skull he'd sprayed above his helmet's visor glared at Callahan with as much fury as Foe's eyes offered.
"Go after her!"
"She's dead, mate."
Callahan shook his head.
"We're going after her, but don't rush so much. Cap's right. Getting killed won't do you any good."
He checked his clip and prepared a backup. 10 rounds and he'd have to pull. It wasn't as easy in the bulky armor, but he'd practiced the maneuver for that reason. Foe looked him up and down, his head moving behind the visor.
"I'm good."
"Then let's go."
The others were coming up fast. If they didn't move, they'd be called back into formation. Now they were dogs off the leash, but Ogambe wouldn't let them stay loose if he caught up with them. They would already get chewed up and spit out when everything was over. But the captain understood the value of not actively screaming at anyone who was acting out if they acted out in ways that benefited the company. As far as Callahan was concerned, they'd just volunteered to be scouts. Foe stood up and shook it off. There was a little red around the edges of the new seals on his armor, but it was holding and he wouldn't bleed out. He wasn't stupid enough to try running if the injuries were too deep. The magnetic boots rattled and clanked as they hauled ass, and both of them activated the flashlights on their helmets, giving them a better view of what was ahead. It was enough to slow them down. The corridor was wrong, that was the only way to put it. The preformed walls were distorted. There was something causing them to bubble and break down, so the walls close to them seemed normal, but only a dozen feet away, the material was expanding and bubbling outward like badly blistered flesh.
"Fucking walls have herpes,"
Foe spat. There was still a lot of debris in the air. Most of it had been human at one point. It was cold enough to have frozen the meat and blood and bone, but the stuff was still careening around the hallway like a bloodied snowstorm. It wasn't helping with seeing what they were looking for.
"Whatever took her is coming back, you can bet your credits on that."
"Why, you say?"
Foe looked his way, scowling.
"I took her for a reason. Whatever it wants, it cut up everyone it could, and it tore Perkins apart. It's coming back."
"I got a grenade."
"Me too, but I'm not blowing the ship apart. Company takes that sort of stuff personally."
Callahan started forward again, trying to squint past the floating matter he didn't want to think about too carefully.
"Besides, I want that bonus."
"Bonus don't matter if you're dead."
"I'm not planning on dying."
Lights flickered in the distance, the same sort that flickered outside the ship. Every bit of flotsam and jetsam in their way was highlighted by the strobes, turned black and white before it became technicolor again.
"Messing with my eyes."
Foe squinted and continued on. Callahan followed after him, letting his friend's bulk save his eyes from the worst of the lights. Even with Foe in the way, the strain was immediate. He'd heard of visors that automatically compensated for extra glare. They were not standard issue. If you wanted them, you paid. If the bonus was big enough. The metal slammed down the corridor at high speed, and both Foe and Callahan ducked instinctively. There were joints to the thing, but it was mostly just a long run of metal with cables attached. Here and there, along the entire length, were spots where the metal seemed to vanish, and others where the lights were too bright to see properly. Foe shot at it anyway and punched three holes, close enough together to sever the thing. But it had already gone past them, ricocheted and wobbled as it filled the corridor. The part that was still connected further on down the hallway continued on. Foe got up, and Callahan followed, and they ran now, hauling ass down the hallway to see what the limb was attached to. It kept coming, slipping past them. It was close to 100 feet in length, if he was right. From behind them, more lights strobed. These were different. They knew the signature flare of plasma rounds when they saw them. "Fucking hope they don't hit us!" Before Callahan could answer, the thing came for them. He knew parts of it wouldn't be seen by his eyes. That didn't help him out at all, because it was big enough to fill most of the corridor. Whatever it was made of, it was covered in burnt blood and worse nightmares. There were too many limbs to count coming off the thing, most of them much shorter than the telescoping thing Foe had cut in half. They were all shapes and sizes, and about half of them were ramming into the walls, cutting through the plastic to gain purchase as it humped and thudded its way toward them. Rather than focus on the whole of the thing, Callahan aimed for the parts that were lit up and started firing. Foe peppered the surface of the behemoth coming their way. Neither of them seemed to cause much damage, but it came at them even faster than before. Every time it moved, more of the lights showed. There was no symmetry to the thing. It had moving parts, but they made as little sense as the vast number of arms it used to shuffle forward. Then one of the limbs pistoned out and cut off Foe's arm just below the shoulder. The metal blurred and Foe screamed, and then there was fresh, warm blood spilling through the air, even as a second limb reached out and wrapped three skeletal metallic fingers around Foe, pulling him toward the main mass. The armor Foe wore did its job again, and the nanofibers started sealing the wound in the armor, likely sealing the source of the bleeding at the same time. Foe didn't fire this time. The blood flow was too sudden and the damage too severe. He was either in shock or unconscious. Callahan looked around to see if backup was there yet.
"This fucking thing just took Foe! Where is everyone?"
Bendez and Ogambe came toward him at a trot. Ogambe spoke into the comlink.
"The others are finding another route. We want to flank it if we can."
He took command that quickly and moved right past Callahan with large strides. The captain was armed with a Hemming 450 assault cannon. He braced himself before he fired off 10 rounds. Ahead of him, the metal thing shuddered and fell back as each round hit and exploded, taking parts of the mechanical beast off with each shell. Big parts. By the time Ogambe was done, there were several new holes that had nothing to do with shining lights. Ogambe looked back at Callahan with a very pissed-off expression.
"You want to tell me where Foe is?
That fucker took him, that's all I know."
It came forward again, new lights flaring into existence as it moved. Both Bendez and Callahan flinched at the pain. Ogambe kept going. His visor had gone dark. Somebody was smart enough to get the upgrades before they met the damn thing. The captain fired again, bracing himself and pounding out another 10 rounds.
"One of you get up here and back me up. I have to reload."
Callahan moved forward, pulling his empty clip and slapping the replacement into the slot without hesitating. Ogambe took up a lot of room, but not enough to fill the entire hallway. He leaned around the man and opened fire, aiming at a dark spot where the machine was already damaged. Each round lit the interior of the thing. He could see Foe's armor locked into the center of the creature, but it was too late to stop his plasma rounds. If Foe was alive, Callahan killed him. He saw the plasma searing through armor like it was butter. That seemed to be enough for the thing. It withdrew, sliding backward down the corridor toward the alien lights. Ogambe was cursing. Callahan just stared. Foe. Damn everything. His body had burned right along with that armor. No two ways about the fact that he'd just murdered his friend. As he was staring, the thing he'd ruined changed. It split open and pulled itself into three separate parts. Each had more mechanical limbs, and each separate piece changed shape. As easily as a master sculptor might rearrange clay, the sections smoothed out and sculpted themselves. The limbs were all toward the front now, and most of them wavered in the air like bug arms as the separate, smaller parts came hammering toward all three of the men. Past the glare of the lights, Callahan could see thick cords behind the main bodies and mechanical pistons and gears that moved nearly too fast for him to identify. There was no time to dwell on foe. It was fight or die, and he wasn't planning on dying. The plasma rounds burned what they hit, but the damned thing seemed to be learning. It moved the main body of shifting parts out of his way until he had to readjust. Metal burned, and a few of those insane limbs were melted out of shape. But then Callahan had to retreat as the entire thing came for him, a half-ton of metal aiming to shred body and armor alike. Agambe opened fire again and blew the main body of the thing coming for him into fragments. It came forward anyway, and what was left of it, mostly jagged blades of shattered steel, caught the captain in the chest and smashed him into the closest wall. The wall gave out. So did Ogambe's armor. The comlink picked up his grunt and the sound of his ribs collapsing in perfect detail. Bendez did better. He was carrying a plasma torch instead of a pulse rifle. The cutters were designed to burn through hulls, and he used his to cut the thing coming for him nearly in half. The force of the attack sent him spinning away, but the attacking module stopped, apparently incapacitated. That just left two of the things to come at Callahan.
"Back away, I'm throwing down!"
Without another word, he pulled the pin on his single grenade and hurled it down the corridor at the lights.
"Callahan, wait!"
Bendez's words came too late. Zero gravity made it look easy, as the metal ball of the grenade rolled far further than he could have thrown it in a gravity field. It made it all the way to the glowing lights that made his eyes feel like they were bleeding, and then the glare changed nature. The light was just as bright, but in the spectrum that his eyes could see. Everything down at the collision point was painted a bright white by that glare, and parts he had not seen materialized just in time to melt under the intense heat. All three of the limbs that had telescoped from the main body were melted away for over half of their length, and the remaining parts deactivated, floating in the zero-G of the ship.
"The fuck are you doing?"
The screams came through the comlink.
"Are you trying to burn us alive?"
Bendez said,
"The other corridor, Callahan. They were coming down the other corridor. Status check, you guys alive?"
"We're here, but I'm kicking someone's ass when this is over."
That was Rollins. She meant it, too.
"Just hit this fucker!"
He couldn't make out that voice, but the result was immediate. Down where he'd melted half of the thing that was exposed and in view, a hail of plasma fire ripped into the alien machinery. In a perfect universe, the juggernaut they were blasting would take a hint and burn away. Whatever the damn thing was, however, it was designed to survive in the extremes of outer space. Some of it melted, true enough. Some of it withered and slagged in the extreme heat. The rest of it reacted as if it had just been burned, and the whole of the thing spilled more of the lights that could only be partially seen. And then it gave birth to something entirely different. A wave of thick fluids bled out from the thing, coating the walls of the corridor and running toward them. Callahan reached for Ogambe and hauled him along, heading back to the airlock and the corridor that led to their ship. The hairs on his scalp were up, and his body felt a chill of goose flesh. Whatever the hell was coming for them, it couldn't be good. Ogambe was alive, but he was whimpering in pain. Ribs had been broken, and there was a real chance he was bleeding internally. Bendez was right behind him. There is a time to fight and a time to run, and when a tidal wave of shit is coming your way, it's time to retreat. They made it to a point where the stuff had not reached, and Bendez looked at his legs.
"Shit got all over me."
Callahan looked too.
"It's doing something to your armor. Get back to the ship and get out of that suit, Bendez. Take Ogambe with you."
What had hit him was translucent, but there were fine fibers running through it. Where the goop was touching Bendez's armor, it was breaking down and being absorbed by the stuff. The armor wasn't melting exactly, but it wasn't going to hold air for much longer if Callahan was right. Bendez nodded and slid the torch off his arm. Take that. Might help. Callahan nodded and pulled the torch along with him. Bendez moved. Dumariste spoke to him. The ops had been silent for so long he'd forgotten about him. Whatever you just did, it pissed that thing off. It's spilling something all over the exterior of the ship. Whatever it is, it's doing heavy damage to the hull.
It's eating the ship.
Callahan spoke softly, horrified.
What? That stuff, I saw it on Benny's armor. It was changing the surface. I think that shit is eating the ship, eating whatever it touches.
He looked carefully at the surfaces that had been touched. Dumariste spoke again.
What the hell is it going to do with it?
It's making repairs. I think it wants to rebuild itself.
Somebody screamed on the comlink. Rollins spoke up over the sound.
It's definitely doing something. We tried to clean it off of Moretti, and it's too damn late.
Her voice was inordinately soft. The lights came back brighter, and the thing that had already hammered at Callahan came down the corridor again. They were alterations. It was adapting to the environment. Instead of multiple limbs, it had restructured much of the same material. You could see the burn marks from previous encounters into a heavy carapace. Thick plates of armor came front and center as it barreled down the way, and it had armed itself. Parts of foe were stuck in there, too, melted and ruined. The only thing that wasn't hurt was the pulse rifle his friend had been holding. For one sick second, Callahan was afraid that damn thing might aim and fire at him. He had to suppress a laugh that was utterly humorous and bordered on insane. From behind the mass that was coming toward him, Callahan saw the familiar flare of plasma fire. Half of the squad had to be firing to make that much light, but he couldn't see them, only the end result of their assault. The burnt, broken, and repaired thing coming to slaughter him shuddered and stopped. Callahan opened his mouth to speak, but Rollins beat him to it.
It's stopping, but not for long. What the hell are we going to do with this thing?
Dumariste asked. What do you mean?
I mean, Callahan was right. It's eating the ship to repair itself. There are tubes sucking in whatever gets melted by the crap it puked up, and those tubes are feeding right into parts that are being built. I don't know what the fuck we're dealing with, but we need to get away from it.
Callahan, I'm not seeing as much, but I think we need to break away the main freight and let this thing either have the rest of the ship or blow it into dust. There is no way in hell we're going to stop it with the ordnance we have.
Rollins said.
Yeah, we already saw what a grenade did. It pissed this fucker off.
Ogambe responded, his voice strained and sounding winded.
Make it happen, Rollins. Your team needs to meet with Callahan and seal the locks. Make the separation clean.
On it, coming from the port side, Callahan. Don't shoot us.
Oh, yes, she was going to kick his ass when this was over.
Just fucking get here. I'm going to try to suppress this thing in the meantime.
A new clip of ammo got locked in place, but he kept the plasma cutter at the ready, in case the thing got too close. He saw the lights from the squad's helmets coming his way on his left. On the right, he saw the thing shudder and start waking up again. Whatever damage they had done, it was quickly repairing itself. Callahan thought about whether or not he could get to it with the plasma cutter before it grew active again, but he didn't like his chances. Rollins led the pack. She looked his way, and he saw the rage she was locking inside.
Why the hell are you standing there? You've got a torch. Burn the locks. We don't have time to set charges.
She pointed at the connecting umbilicals that locked the Shiname Maru to the freight and the remaining crew of the ship. If they were severed, security protocols would lock down the supplies. And after that, it was a matter of using the thrusters from either side to push ship and cargo in different directions. Even as they were speaking, Patel was taking over the port where Perkins had been working earlier. The light off the screen hid Patel's face behind a reflection. Callahan nodded and moved for the starboard umbilical. The heavily insulated locks that held ship and cargo together would each take a minute or so to burn through. The torch's glare was enough to make him squint. The insulation melted quickly enough, and once he started the actual cutting, metal and rubber pooled and rippled into free-form statues as they were burned away from the hole and frozen in the zero-G environment.
Get the fuck down!
Rollins was screaming, and Callahan had to look. The same thing that had stopped before was coming for them, and the squad was braced and firing. No time. He looked away and kept cutting. Demariste spoke up.
The company would rather have the remaining ship left intact.
Agambe came through. He hissed his words for a moment.
The company can have it, long as we get away.
He grunted.
That thing comes for us, we're going to frag it.
Callahan looked down at his handiwork and nodded as the final connections in the first umbilical were severed.
Halfway there.
The lights from the attacking unit flared brightly enough to leave blue phantoms in front of his eyes, but he moved anyway, clunking his way over to the port side, away from the main conflict. So he got to see the machinery coming their way from the other side.
Got more coming on the left!
This one was different, more fluid in design. It rolled quickly and smoothly and had some sort of array at the top. The array looked like it might involve actual weapons, ranged attacks. Rollins was already barking orders. Patel said,
"On it!"
And a moment later a wall smoothly slid down to shut off the corridor. It was thick and hermetically sealed. Callahan breathed a little easier and started cutting away at the second umbilical, flinching automatically each time molten fragments hit his suit. Nothing had burned through yet, but you never knew. The port side's new wall shuddered. The starboard side was bathed in unholy light, and more flares of plasma fire cut long shadows his way that were devoured by the torch. He wasn't a tech guy. He just cut through everything as quickly as he could.
Go faster, Callahan. We need to get back to the dropship and fast.
I'm working as fast as I can, Rollins.
Work faster anyway.
Wollaston screamed out in pain and then cursed. At least the man was still alive.
Got it.
The last wire burned through when he pulled back. Patel said,
"Let's go. I'm ready to blow the docking locks."
The wall on the port side was glowing and starting to melt near the top. It bubbled in their direction. Callahan didn't have to be told twice to vacate. He moved toward the sealed airlock. On the starboard side, he saw how bad things had gotten. Two of his companions were injured, one was missing, and two weren't moving. The other five were still firing and retreating. Patel shoved past him and tapped the controls on the airlock.
"Come on, people, let's go, let's go!"
Callahan readied his weapons and looked at the port wall. Everyone needed to get away. Rollins and the rest were coming and dragging the wounded with them. Someone, he thought it was Morneau, had lost a leg. The environment suit had sealed the wound nice and neat, but that didn't mean much. The leg was floating near the battered and currently unmoving monstrosity that had already done so much damage. Even as he watched, more of the thick liquids spilled from the walls around the broken machinery. The walls obligingly blistered and started to bubble out into whatever sort of building materials that fucking thing ate. Patel thumped him on the shoulder.
Go!
Callahan listened. They made their way through the airlocks and onto their own jump ship as quickly as they could. When they were all in place, Patel hit the keypad on the jump side and then sagged against the wall in his thick armored suit.
We're ready, Demariste.
Patel spoke softly. The response was immediate. The ship moved, surging away from the interlocking umbilical. As soon as they were far enough away, Patel blew the charges, and the vast store of supplies meant to build another colony slid away from the Shiname Maru. Despite himself, Callahan looked over at the company ship. Over half of the hull was blistering, as whatever the hell was stuck to the ship continued to feast.
We need to blow that thing up.
Patel looked his way.
Why?
It gets strong enough. If it rebuilds itself, it might try to follow us.
The company wants it intact.
They're bug shit crazy.
Bendez had all that stuff on his armor. Callahan wondered what was left of the environment suit, and what had been done with the liquid that had been absorbing it.
Besides, I think they already got their samples.
Rollins was the one who answered him.
Yeah? Well, we all love incentives.
She sounded as tired as he felt.
Dangerous Prey by Scott Sigler. The Protector hides in the shadows. It is damaged. It waits. It listens. Its cadre is gone, killed by the dangerous prey. The Protector feels no familiar taps, hears no identifying sounds. The protector smells the scents of the cadre, but the individual's signatures are hidden beneath the mostly uniform death scent. The protector hears and feels the presence